tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment.
Johnson.
AfterBuzz TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Prisoner After Show here on AfterBuzz TV. 45 plus years in the making, and here we are talking about it. I'm very excited. I have Steph C. on the panel.
What's up, guys?
Meredith Placco.
Hey, hey, hey.
And I, of course, am Phil Svitek. And so I kind of want to give... This is our introduction episode, right?
Yes.
This is the first episode that we're going to talk about. So we are beginning a 17-week journey.
Yes.
Into the village.
Together.
Yay. Now, Meredith and I have seen the village.
A few times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Steph C, you're a newcomer.
I'm a new villager. I am. I love it. I'm very, very excited.
What's her number?
I'm number 15.
Number 15?
That's my lucky number.
Okay.
Because I just like it. What's your guys' number?
I'm not a number.
Oh. Yeah, I'm a person, okay? Yeah. I'm not a number. But if I had to be, if you can't beat them, join them.
So I'm number 15.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. Well, as mentioned, we will dissect every single episode of The Prisoner for, one a week. And so we urge you to guys kind of come along, subscribe, rate, and comment. We really want to build this up, and we want to talk about everything to the fullest extent that we can. You know, there's going to be some things that you might be like, oh, you guys missed it talking about this week. Again, we have 17 weeks, so we're pacing ourselves. So if we don't get to it right away in today's episode, don't worry. We have 16 left after this. And yes, at times it will be a little bit spoiler filled, but not enough to, we won't give away endings and things like that. So if you are like Steph C, you have the ability to participate and partake. And I also want to give a quick shout out to 6 of 1 Appreciation Society. They've been supporting us in this kind of venture. This is 5 years in the making for me. I've wanted to do this for 5 years, and I finally found the panel of my dreams to be able to do this.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I've never seen you so excited and so prepared. Some of the other shows I do with you, Phil, he just shows up like, yeah, what's the information? And he's like, I got my notes. He gave us notes. Yeah, he gave us all the notes.
You can't give away my trade secrets.
I mean, I'm just trying to give you a pat on the back. Well done, Phil.
All right. Well, today we're talking about... obviously, episode one, and there's no discrepancy here because obviously there's a huge discrepancy in episode order, but there's no discrepancy. Arrival has to be the first episode we talk about because it is the first episode.
Right.
Let's start with this. Steph C, overall impressions, and then we'll move on to you, Meredith.
Overall, the first note that I wrote was it felt very James Bond-like, which I liked. I liked this... You're not getting all the information. There's a lot of subliminal information, which I really like. There's a lot of puzzle pieces being dropped, and you kind of have to put them together. Even how they open the episode with him driving in that awesome Lotus. And clearly he's going to, give his resignation. But if you would have never seen the show before, you would be like, oh, what's he doing? And then, later it ties back to what he was doing and how he was feeling, great and free. And then he winds up in this village, and you're like, what's going on? It's kind of like the Stepford Wives, but not. And it's this crazy thing where he's stuck and he thinks that he's going to be able to escape and get out, but clearly the prisoner, that's not going to happen. So, I do, I think I'm really excited for what's going to happen here. I mean, even though this is such a period piece when it's, 45 years ago, there's certain things that, with our culture, with the technology in these shows, there's certain things that tie into things that are happening today. So I feel like it's a very, I'm super excited we're talking about it.
And Meredith, for you.
Well, so having watched it originally when I was probably 13, I obviously didn't understand a lot of the messages that were being put forth. I just thought it was a really quirky, weird British show that my godparents were showing me. But having rewatched it just recently, I was So one of the things that actually stood out for me with the first episode was how disjointed it was. And I know it's meant to be, well, it's not meant to be, it's because they kind of shot everything in two really tight segments and everything was kind of pieced together last minute, but it actually added to the disjointment that number six feels, having been thrown into this completely new world without any, you know, reason or rhyme behind it. So I feel like in a lot of ways, like, while that might have not been a stylistic choice that the directors made, in hindsight, it actually works as a viewer to kind of like really discombobulate you and make you feel very unease at being placed. Like, hey, I fell asleep, or I was like getting ready to leave, and then suddenly I'm knocked out and I wake up in this weird Stepford village. And but yeah, so I'm excited about that. I'm excited to revisit this journey and see what number six is up to again. And I forgot how much I liked Rover.
Nah, yes, we'll certainly talk about Rover. And for me, I was first introduced to it in college and as part of a, you know, media studies class. And I kind of fell in love with it and then took the initiative to watch it on my own. And hence, you know, I was just always drawn to it. You know, I never fully understood what it meant. And so part of the reason why we're digging into this is because we still to this day want information. And yes, that's a double play that Steph Z will fully understand in by episode two or three.
I feel like the IN in capitalized and the rest of the word not in our handy dandy notes meant something. So
it
I'm looking
it
forward
does.
To it. And also, while you guys are watching out there, if you guys want to tweet us at hashtag ABTV, the prisoner. We'd love to interact with you guys, answer any questions, you know, follow along.
Yeah, and I felt it was important for, you know, we'll kind of, this show, one of the reasons why it survived is because it's so personal. And so that's why I wanted to get your guys' initial thoughts. And if you guys at home, take a minute, whether you're watching this live or not, let us know what drew you into this. You know, we'd love to see that. So speaking of, everyone said they were drawn in from the opening. So let's talk about this opening sequence because, you know, it becomes the title sequence for the rest of the episodes, just a little bit more condensed. You love the Lotus 7. You love this configurement. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you're watching it, what do you gather from it?
Well, I gathered freedom being taken away in a sense. Like when you're driving, I mean, I actually own a convertible as well. So there's nothing more free than feeling when you're driving with the wind in your hair. You know what I mean? Like I feel like that's such a free, universal free visual.
Yeah.
So you see that and then that quickly is taken away. So that was kind of my initial like, oh, man. What happened to him?
And, you know, for me, you know, when he walks into, there's a formulaity to it. You know, he's giving an official resignation, and so everything's kind of official. Except when he gets there, he's screaming. What do you interpret
there's
from
that? There's a bit of anti-establishment in that moment. I mean, he's sitting there and saying, I'm done with this. I am over this. I am not, you know, and we see this reinforced with the punch card being filed. You know, he without saying it in words, it's when he first says, I'm not a number. That's to me anyways.
All right. What you first time watching it, what did you...
From when he gave the letter?
Yeah, because, I mean, he's screaming here at somebody. We don't quite know, you know, we assume that it's his boss or somebody.
Well, but as a first-time viewer, if you don't know the story, you don't know that that's his boss until later when you see number two asking him about the resignation, and that's when you put it together. So I'm just watching in the space of this guy's free. What did he just have to deliver? Who is this other person? You know what I mean? And then you put it together and you realize clearly something happened. He wasn't treated the right way. You know what I mean? Like, and he was sticking up for himself and having that moment of, you know, screw you.
I have a question. Did you get that he was like a spy at first, or what was your like first impressions of what his role was?
I got that he was a spy just because of the way that it was shot. Like I said, like the opening scene seemed very James Bond like to me. Very, you know how it just felt like it. Like I could have turned this on and been like, oh, what James Bond movie is this? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I did get that.
And we'll talk a little bit about the parallels of James Bond. Definitely in this episode.
Right.
Now, you know, as soon as there's a lot of signs and symbols, right? We have the Hearst following him. And then as soon as he gets home, he's still kind of in that hectic mode, you know, he's grabbing any things that he can, and we don't know where he's going, but again, what can you take from that? Is he escaping? What is he trying to do?
I mean, I felt he was running away. I felt there was something very urgent that he needed to go and not be where he was anymore. And it's just really one of those. He's like, I am running away. I don't want to be involved in this anymore. I'm mm-hmm. done. I've had it.
I agree with that. I feel like he was done. He had it. And I also think that in grabbing the certain stuff, that was the only stuff that he needed. Like, he didn't need all the rest of the stuff that he had. Or maybe he just needed these few things to feel at home. And I almost got a sense of that because, you know, we get that he's a spy. And you know what I mean? Because of all this, maybe he's always on the run. Maybe he doesn't have a home. Maybe he can't have all the normal stuff because his life is such a secret, so to speak. So he was just – there was only a few things I felt that he – I don't know. Maybe I'm an overpacker. That's why. But, like, you know, it seemed like he only grabbed a few things that he needed.
And then there was the photo of the beach, the resort, which to me was just like, this is where I want to go next.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's – I want to ask you guys in that sense, so the beach and all that, right? Anytime you get out of the business, you know, in typical genre fashion, you have to become anonymous, right? You go away in the, you know, an island or whatever. That's the typical thing. But, you know, in hindsight – where is he going to go? Because the only way that, you know, he says he's not a number, he's not a free man, he's a free man. So is the only way to be that is to be anonymous and not part of anything, not be known, you know, because we've seen that.
I think it's interesting because as a spy, you kind of already are anonymous. You lead so many different lives. And I almost wonder if, this is actually just something I'm touching on in general. I wonder if there's something about, and we see in later, you know, later this episode and even later episodes that why he fights so hard against being an established number, a single individual, because he has actually led a life of anonymity for so long that I don't think he even would know how to handle having to establish something. So I think if he runs away to be anonymous, that's probably what he's most comfortable at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay.
I would, because it makes complete sense, because people don't, it's not like when you're a spy, you can't go home and be like, so, you know what I did today? You know what I mean? Like, he's had to keep everything within, and he's had to have this dual or two or three or four double lives to whoever or, you know, is involved in certain different aspects of his life.
And that's a good point because, you know, he lives alone, right? Yeah. You know, even as a first-time viewer, it's not like, you know, you might assume that maybe he's running away for, like, he's leaving his family, but you don't.
Yeah.
I don't think
so. There's no indication in the home.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like he grabs one last photo of, like, here's the kids.
Yeah, or looks at it. He didn't, like, you know, looks at it and is like, sorry, I gotta go. You know what I mean? Like, he's just like, I got my stuff.
So, yeah, I think that's a fair point to establish. And so, you know, he's taken, he's gassed up, and he awakes. And originally in the script, it was supposed to be not exactly like his house. Mm-hmm. But they altered it, obviously, in the actual episode, that it is his full house. And the only thing that is different is he wakes up in this village.
Yeah.
And here we are.
I just love the village itself because of the bright colors and the – oh, it's very Animal Farm when you think about it. Like, it's just so – like, Stepford Animal Farm, everything about it is just so off-putting because it's so perfect.
It's kind of funny. Yeah, I love the village show. I wouldn't mind going there for like a weekend or a week, even a week. Yeah. And one of the things that stood out most to me, like in taking in the whole village, was the map of the village. Like, I love that he was like, no, I need a bigger map, you know? And it's like the same thing.
Literally,
like,
just a mountains. Bigger map.
Yeah. And it was like this perfect, like everything you need. Like, here's some mountains, you know? It was all contained. And it did look beautiful. It was very deceiving in a way, because you would think you'd want to be there. Like, if I woke up there, I'd be like, sweet, who scooped me up and took me away?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and that was the whole thing. We'll kind of talk about the full behind the scenes making of it, but a lot of people went here, whether it's the Beatles manager, whether it's H.G. Wells, you know, it was intended as a getaway, but obviously they flipped that, you know, the meaning of a getaway, and you know, because you said it perfectly, a weekend trip.
Right.
I don't think you'd want to be there for longer than that.
I might be able to do a week. Look, I didn't see there's a few
couple
cocktails.
Things to do there. Yeah, you know, they have the stone ship.
Yeah, go for a helicopter ride. Run away from a ball.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this specifically. They made, obviously, you know, we saw the map, but as it's shot, we never fully get a sense of the full geography.
Right.
Did you feel like you knew this place, even though, again, just based off of the map?
I mean, I feel like there was something familiar about it. You know, it was like this village set aside, like this mountainside village that has, you know, the water near. You know, there wasn't, you know, it felt very common as a getaway place.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we didn't really get the full scope of it. But I think, again, that like kind of also added to the whole feeling trapped because we didn't really get to see, like, there's no big wide shot of the whole area, you know, a lot of tight, close, you know, here's this, here's that. And I feel, you know, that really kind of kept me feeling enclosed and imprisoned.
Absolutely, you know, and... You know, so you're very right on that. And then Steph, going to yours, in terms of it felt familiar. Yeah, because when you look at the map, right, the sea. Who doesn't know? If you understand English, you know what a sea is. You know what the mountains are. What this is. So it yes, you know, it's like, oh yeah, I know these words.
Right, it's familiar but different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Creepier. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, but you can understand. I mean, you know, one of the things that always stood out to me was how quick he was to be worried about where he was. And you know, I don't know his background, but I guess he has a right to be, you know, from his perspective. Again, I would be like, oh, this is cool. But prisoner, obviously not.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that, like, I thought it was weird they never tried to play off the fact, like, oh, no, look, you're on your beach resort. This is where you just fell and hit your head or you forgot. Like, they never, the powers that be, number two and so forth, never tried to BS him. They never tried to, like, make it seem it was anything but, you know, you're here, you have to deal with it, just learn to accept it and fall in line. And I found that really interesting because it just kind of set the precedent that, you know, you have to accept this. And it really, to me, that set the main tone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that you bring up, because when, you know, I feel like if you wanted to get information from somebody and you put them in this new, you know, creepy, weird environment, that you might want to do a little stroking in order to get the information out. So, you know, you could play that both sides. But yeah, I mean, it was right away, you know, if I was there, right away when you heard, like, creepy things over the loudspeaker everywhere. I mean, I don't know. I'd be a fan of the doors opening for me. Like, I'm okay with that, you know.
I like grocery stores opening up for me,
Yeah, but it's like when it was very creepy very quickly there.
Here's what I will say about that. I mean, part of it is if it almost is a double play, right? There's a quote in A Most Violent Year. This is the hardest thing you'll ever have to do is look someone in the eye and tell them the truth. So in many ways, they're telling him the truth. And yet not, right? And so it's that double play of, like, you know, pretend that we're truthful with you, but in reality we're not, and because we need you to be 100% truthful with us.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I think they give number six his credit that they're not gonna pull the wool over his eyes. They're not going to try to insult him in direct ways. You know, it's going to be a more like, you know, and as we see later in the episode, and I won't spoil that yet, is what they do with a certain character to try to, you know, get him to open up.
You know what was interesting for me as a first-time viewer is I found myself questioning, like, it was clear that they wanted some sort of information from him and he had these relationships and this past, but it wasn't clear to me whether or not all the other people in the village were taken there for the same reason or they were just there.
Yeah, it's hard to say who, like, are they all former spies? Are some of them, you know, also, like, part of the village management? Like, how many of them are exactly. Like, why are they there and what are their
Because he
roles?
Seems to be, you know, a pretty important character. Clearly, he's the main character. But you know what I mean? Like, he seems to be someone that has, they want to extract information from him. So are all these other people there by default, you know, besides the people that are working there? Like, why are they there, too? Why did he wind up with them?
Did some of the elderly choose to just retire there? Because it's like, hey, we can just get taken care of versus, you know?
Yeah, maybe.
We'll discuss all that. And there's so much to discuss.
So much.
I know.
So good.
You know, our number, we don't know his number yet. We don't know his name. He gets a phone call to go and meet up and, it wasn't originally the Green Dome, right? It was supposed to be something else. And then because of the way it looked and they wanted to keep with very, very vague terms, the Green Dome. I mean, that's what a title. right? And that's where we meet number two, as Pop Goes the Weasel plays.
Not creepy at all. Creepy at all.
So what did you, you know, meeting number two for the first time, what did you guys like about this scene? What do you think was established? What did you learn?
You want me to go first?
Oh, no. I mean, I'm always so nice. I'm like, I'm going to defer to you.
Yeah, go ahead.
The thing I liked about it was it really set up just kind of an authority figure. It kind of set up like, you know, and again, going back to what I said earlier, this is kind of where we start to see the, we're going to try to put the line out there and tell you this is what's going on in their own, you know, way of withholding information. And it really is just kind of, this is what sets the conflict up. And this is where, you know, me as a viewer started watching and I was like, okay, this is the bad guy. I can't trust him. I also, at that point is when I started questioning, what side they were really on in terms of, is this really the British government or is this something else?
Well, so let's, you know, go ahead, Steph, and then we can talk about that question specifically.
For me, it just established that he was there for the wrong reasons. Like, I felt that right away in the scene where they were showing that they knew so much about him. Like, how they're like, two eggs, you know what I mean? The chair got up. There was just so much that, like, it showed that they had been looking specifically for him. That, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, there was no accident that he was there. There was no question that they wanted something specific from me. And for me, at that point, I was like, oh, this is going to be bad. Like, they don't want him to help. It's like they almost want to use him for something. That's kind of what I felt when I saw that scene.
Absolutely. And, you know, so one of the biggest questions raised in this portion is whose side is the village on, right? You know, we and everyone's given numbers, so who's number one, but which side is the village on? And you, because of earlier stuff, you could be like, okay, these are the communists, or the fact that they have so much information on him to begin with and so fast, especially after his resignation, points to the fact that they could be, you know, the British government and saying, hey, we, you know, are you defecting?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, that, so, you know, that obviously isn't answered, certainly not here, but that's the question that's raised. And I would argue because of the amount of information that they have, you're led to believe that perhaps it is the British government, but we'll find, you know, there's, ironically, just in this very same episode, contradicting evidence.
Exactly.
So.
Right.
So I
enjoy them. We can be really weird and also start pulling from Danger Man.
Yes.
Yes.
By the way,
we'll have to talk about that at some point too.
Absolutely. Full disclosure, I have not seen a single episode of Danger Man, unfortunately.
I feel that should be our next after this. We're going to go do this. Yeah. We're going to go back. We're going to go back even further.
The prologue.
Yep, the prologue.
In hindsight, maybe we should have done that one first and then gotten to this one.
Nah, this is fun.
Double time.
All right. And what I love is it's one of those, you know, it's a very set up sort of episode, right? But we set up two things. One, we set up that there's a helicopter, and we set up the village. And going back to your earlier point, yes, we see the village from an aerial view, and you would think that we would see all of it, but mm-hmm. we don't. We still only get chunks, right. Never a full thing. And I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
That kind of almost makes me – that leads me to believe it's a secret village.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some extent it is.
If no one can get out, can people get in?
That's what I mean. Like, does anyone else know it's there?
That's a good question.
I don't know.
Sure. You know?
Do you guys know the answer?
That's something. Save that question for later episodes because we'll certainly debate it, you know?
Okay.
And by the way, one of the things that I definitely can say, if you're, you know, you don't find out where the village is, and that's unfortunately something that we will have to spoil the location of the shoe.
Yeah.
But that was never said until the very end.
Yeah.
Well, aren't we going there for our finale episode? Episode 17, we're going to go shoot from London. I thought that was...
Oh.
That's why I signed up for this.
Maybe.
I like this plan. I'm happy to be a part of it.
Only, but you guys will be abducted there.
Oh, okay, that's... I mean, yes. That's
blindfold me and take me. Happy.
See, that's... I can't have you be happy about this.
I'll scream. I'll rage. Don't worry.
But that's almost like... The part of it is if people are happy there, it defeats the purpose. So it's almost like you should act happy. Like, oh, thanks for the eggs, man.
Yeah, I'm like, secretly plotting to kill everyone.
Well, you know, that's a form of a rebellion that we'll see if it's explored. Okay. So as we're in the helicopter, right, we're getting the protocol of the village and everything. Anything that stood out to you? I mean, it was, again, fairly, for a town, everything seemed to run smoothly. Yes, some minor differences here and there, but that's, you can call that cultural.
Mm-hmm. It stood out to me that no one seems to question the way this village is run, except him at the current time. They've all kind of just succumbed to the way that it is. And maybe it's because they've been there for a while and they've all tried to escape before, and who knows? You know what I mean? But there's no, like, everyone there is pretty much just robotic to a sense.
Yeah. And nobody does anything for themselves. Everything is done for them.
Yeah.
They have maids, they have taxi services, I can't even think of a time when I see someone cooking for themselves.
Sign me up.
You're like, I'm just ready. Give me my number. I'm number 15 right here.
Come on. 15.
Well, that was one of the things later on that I was going to talk about was the idea of childishness. But, since we're on it, let's talk about it now. You're right. There's no one does anything for themselves. I mean, on the announcements, ice cream. Yeah. Go get your ice cream. How more childish can you be? And conversely, number six is treated like a child, and in many ways like a child. He has to prove himself to his parents that he is an individual.
Uh-huh. I like where you're going there.
See? But you guys want to expand upon that further? As I find my notes on this, so I can.
I didn't mean to jump ahead. I was just like, in the Protocol of the Village, I just thought that was interesting how no one did anything, and maybe a little bit less on the whole idea of childishness is that in a way to indoctrinate people, to get them more comfortable, is that you take, and again, almost like a child trying to find its identity, you take away the things that they do to make them feel like individuals, and that further isolates them and conforms them, and it's just another form of that manipulation to get them to be where they want to be. And that's just something I, from the announcements to here's your new job assignment, at the one place, or here's the one cafe in town. It's just, to me, that's the one thing that kind of struck out more than anything, is that they're taking away every ounce of your individuality. And I, going on to the whole, treating everyone like children, that does set up a bigger picture for number six and how he has to reestablish his identity.
Absolutely. And, there's so many symbols there, right? We mentioned Pop Goes the Weasel. In the labor exchange, they're singing the tune of Boys and Girls Come Out to Play. You mentioned no one does anything for themselves. And so, yeah, very, very childlike. And this happens a little bit later, but in the hospital, there's almost like a grandmother over him, and she calls him son.
Mm-hmm. I also felt, again, with the childish, just to add a little bit to what you were saying, Meredith, it's like, I feel like it's almost brainwashing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not, I don't believe the intention is to make it easy and make these people feel like they're kids. You know what I mean? I feel like it's very much set up, to take away the individuality and to brainwash them. I wouldn't even be surprised if there's subliminal messages in stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
Maybe you guys know that because I got a smile. But you know what I mean? Is the ice cream laced? I don't know. It might be. Is it funny ice cream?
You could be right, actually.
Yeah. Who knows?
You could be right. But you're right in the sense that, children are the most easily molded.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because if you notice, very few people fight. We see one scene in the walking through the village where there's someone falling out of line.
Waldo. Waldo go out of line.
Yeah.
He's wearing red and white stripes, man.
Where's Waldo? There he is.
And then he got, suffocated by the big Zorb ball.
Okay, we're on Rover. Let's talk about Rover. This is, we're introduced to Rover, and there's so much history. I mean, this could be an episode in itself talking about this thing. Right, and the picture that we're looking at, it's not from this portion of the episode, it's a little bit later on, but it's the best I could find. Okay, so you called it the big orb ball.
Zorb ball. Do you know what a Zorb ball is? You can actually get in the middle of it and walk around inside.
Oh, is that
it.
Like you see them in Vegas?
Yeah.
Like a hamster ball.
Yeah.
So you're...
Excuse me. Yeah, but it's fun. So, you know what I mean?
This rover's not fun.
Rover's definitely not fun. But it kind of made me feel like that.
Fair enough. And Meredith, I mean, this was something that you wanted to speak to heavily.
Well, so one of the things I noticed, again, on rewatching it, is how much it resembled a weather balloon and how it harkened back to a lot of like the UFO and not just terms of in like alien UFOs, but like actual military unidentified planes and technology they were conducting at the time, that this felt very real to me in a modern day sense, that this is just like one of those elements that they brought about, and it kind of explored like other technology at the time. Because I know one of the things we were talking about is the use of technology. And that's something I know we're going to go into further, is just, you know, how technology and the progression of technology is going faster than man can handle at this point. And I feel like this is almost like a reminder of like, this is government playing with something outside of their control.
Yeah. And Alexis, our wonderful engineer, there's a photo of UFOs and things like that. Again, we were supposed to talk about it later, but since we're on it, if you can bring that up for at least the viewers. Because here's the thing. I looked at, you know, the picture we're about to bring up. It has all these kind of government airplanes and the way they look. And the weather balloon, the symbol for it, is like a UFO.
Yeah,
and I found that to be the most interesting thing, part of it. So by the way, we're showing various photos. So if you're not necessarily watching us, there is a link in the description for you to download all of these photos. It's a zip file. I promise it's not a virus. I'm not, you know, we're not out to get you. We're not number two or number one or whatever you believe. It's just, you know, if you're listening, we want you to have the ability to look at these photos and see them. So there you go. So
I like that the Star Trek Enterprise is also a weather balloon.
And Batman.
Interesting.
There you go.
But yeah, no, I one of the things I found, cause I mean, I don't know. I like aliens, so I like to talk about aliens.
Me too.
Aliens. Yes, we should have an alien show.
We totally
But is, just the, you know, the way they made Rover just this, uniform object, this unsettling thing that, you know, and again, this is more of a British show than it is American, so I am kind of imposing my own, like, cultural history onto it, but it really added this element of sci-fi to this film, that they're like, how does a government in the 60s have technology like this? And so I thought it was a nice, if nothing else, a nice nod to what was going on over, you know, in Pensacola at the time, New Mexico, and a lot of the sightings, the weird sightings. Because I actually remember as a child watching this, I was like, oh my God, are there aliens? Is that who captured them? I actually thought, before I got further into it, I thought it was about aliens. So I think, but now as an adult, I wonder about the choices.
Well, you know, sorry not to cut you off, but like, again, it's spherical, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll certainly talk about kind of the global village as it may be, you know, as represented in later episodes, but you have that idea. In the control room, we see not only the spinning spheres and things like that, we see a map of the universe kind of behind them.
Yeah,
and so it's, you know, there's evidence that could support that theory of like, you know, especially early on where you were trying to piece together any meaning you can.
Right. My thing too, that it struck for me, is that I wonder if this show would have been on American television, I feel like it would have been more censored. I feel like when we see things from Europe and shows that are on BBC or whatever network this was on, it's more truthful. Like, they give you more information. They're not as censored with government and things going on. I feel like across the board they are. So I wonder.
Well, we'll certainly talk about that. It's interesting because it's not BBC.
Yeah, it's ITC.
ITC, and it did air in the U.S. So we'll certainly talk about that towards the a little bit.
Well, also, I can add some flavor from insight on like how British intelligence works. So I think it's kind of I don't know. I think this is definitely a very anti-establishment TV show.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that we would see.
Yeah.
We would have seen them create that show here in that time. It was much more like, we are strong. We are America.
Well, to that,
like, they don't want you to question, because this show is opening the doors to question things, and which is funny because in the village they're trying to brainwash you so that you don't question things. They almost, not only are they taking away your identity, but they're taking away your power, because if you don't want to think, if they force you to not think outside the box, you think that that's just how the world exists, rather than questioning like, why is this big Zorb ball flying around? Why can you take over the helicopter? Like, why can you do these things that, you know what I mean? I feel like it's very much breaking down power as well.
You're right.
No, I 100% agree. I forgot what
I
was going to say.
Sorry.
No, you were flowing well, and you had a great statement, and then I was going to add to it, and then I forgot. So to that point, right? Kind of Rover, mm-hmm. for all intents and purposes, this was an accident, right? That's the beauty of it to me. And it's one of those things that it was a happy accident. And you can say like, oh, just things kind of align and they happen this mm-hmm. way. But if you're like these guys, that was very much the intent. And so they were looking for these things. And so Rover, a mechanical machine that was supposed to, you know, be there on the set that day, mm-hmm. broke down. I believe it went into the water, yeah. never came out. And so they're like, okay, how do we fix this? You know, we need a solution. We need something. And they all, I think it was Bernie Williams. They looked up at the screen. What about that? And again, it's completely happenstance. But when you're looking for ideas and solutions, mm-hmm. this is what comes of it. And it's one of the greatest talking points of this show.
And that's what something I absolutely love about it, is that we as viewers impose our own thoughts. And even, you know, 50 years later, we're still imposing like our modern day ideas of supervision on this. So I think I'm so excited for your opinion on all this.
Well, it is very true, because if you really think about it, it's almost like the village, and this is going to be maybe a little bit left, but the village is like our government in certain ways. It puts lots of restrictions on it. It's almost also religion-like. It's almost also cult-like. There's a lot of mm-hmm. ways that people still act that, I mean, they might not put you in a village and talk over a loudspeaker and do your laundry, but they still try and do certain things in order to make you act in a certain way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I mean, you know, you could call it democratic in the sense of like, you know, you can argue one way or the other in terms of politics, Republican versus Democratic, and obviously all the other spectrums.
Well, on the other end of it, you know, this could also be, say, this is the idealized version of communism, where everyone works together and everyone's equal in almost every way, except for, you know, there's always going to be the people who are in charge, but.
Right. Which is the ultimate failure of communism. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. See, that's a great point why this could be. It just adds question to it.
And it's kind of funny, too, because I don't know if, you know, thinking in retrospect, it's like, do the people that are creating a show like this think that 45 years later they're going to be sparking this conversation about, you know, life and communism and society and government? Like, I think that's pretty amazing that that's what happens from there. Like, oh, let's have this little spy show. You know, like, I'm sure there's a lot more thought into that than that. But, you know, sometimes there's certain shows that are worth talking about 45 years later because they played into, like, does life imitate art or does art imitate life? That whole game.
Absolutely. So kind of getting back to the story, and again, we'll mm-hmm. we'll talk about more of these things as well. I mean, we're only like on the first page of many.
Sorry, everyone.
We're going
to
be here
till
like 6
say.
O'clock tonight. No?
Yeah. That's just for the first episode. But okay, so we get a glimpse of someone in his house, and we eventually find out that it's the maid, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, again, I look at this as two episodes in one that has to present the formula. And so one of the formulaic elements is that there's always going to be a female character that he will not have a romance with, but that is part of the establishment but sympathizes with him. And we got that. I mean, she broke down in tears and said, you know, help me.
Yeah.
Give me anything. I'm going to be saved. And I thought his line of questioning is, you know, do you really believe that, knowing what you've been given?
So. Yeah. I agree. I like the first time we actually see the maid as well, when he kind of yells at her mm-hmm. and is like, I don't want to be part of this. I don't want you to do this. And then she comes back again, you know, showing that, well, that's, you know, quote unquote, what she's supposed to be doing. I mean, we, of course, find out that she's literally just trying to extract information for him for number two. But, I don't know. I felt like everyone's drinking the Kool-Aid there.
Yeah.
They really are.
Well, you know, do you believe that she's been there since, you know, her childhood, as she states?
If that's the case, then this operation's been going on for 20-plus years, and that's...
Do we see any other kids there?
Only young.
Yeah.
Yeah, really young. To me, the whole maid just pulls into question, you know, again, I was asking earlier, is she part of the establishment, or is she a go-between? Is she this, you know, creature that maybe was brought in because she herself was a spy, but, you know, fell in line so much that she was given more responsibility. And through that, maybe a little bit more freedom. You know, they kind of dole out little bits of freedom by giving you more power over other people.
Oh, see, I think the maids are part of the establishment, mm-hmm. and they're there to look through information, to gather information, and report back to them.
They're spies on spies.
Yeah, they're almost like spies. Exactly. They're spies on spies because they would have the access. You wouldn't think that it's happening. Because I don't know that he knows that she's going to run back to them. I mean, yes, he gets that she's not going to be free and tells her, like, wake up. Like, even if you get information from me, it's not going to help you. But I don't think he, in his head, goes as far as thinking that the maid is working for number two.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and kind of going further, right, he breaks the radio, which was a scene stolen from Marx Brothers Duck Soup, by the way. But, you know, so we'll kind of talk about the, you know, him driving over. That's a whole separate conversation we'll have. But the idea that, you know, every one of these people, right, whether or not the maid is it has a higher purpose or not, just let's talk about her as a maid and then this guy as an electrician and, you know, a cab driver and this, and this. Would you ever get the sense that these guys, after they're done with work, would ever go to the cafe and have a drink together or enjoy time together, anything beyond their job?
No.
No.
And that's part of, like, everyone's treated almost like they have a purpose, mm-hmm. and if they don't fulfill that
they're
purpose,
like
they have no...
like robots.
Yeah. No individuality beyond that. Mm. And they are literally defined by the job that they do.
Yeah, that's pretty sad. They all need to, like, have a whiskey together, lighten up.
So many great things in the village, but not, you know, you can't enjoy any of them.
No.
So... But for me, this is kind of after this little moment. That's where the first part of the episode really ends. And then, you know, we go and meet a friend who is Cobb. Going back, it starts with because Rover gets him.
Yeah, he attempts to
escape.
Yeah. He does a couple of times.
And let me ask you this. Was that the smartest play? Because, I mean, you know, you've seen what possibly can happen. I mean, is he just testing the waters?
I was just gonna say, I mean, as his level, he would just test to see. Like, I don't even feel that was a real attempt at escape. I think it was him just seeing what the boundaries were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think he's smart enough to know he's being surveillanced.
Yeah.
So but in the same sense, he could have done it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have, like, made it like he was playing by their rules and found out that information so that it wasn't such a surprise when he tries to escape.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, regardless, he ends up in the hospital, and the only man to get a name in this entire episode, Cobb. Yeah. And we meet Cobb in the hospital, who's you know, he seems to know very well, but was over in Germany and ended up here.
So interesting. If he was just in Germany, amazing how he ended up there so fast. Hard to say where the village is.
Well, let me ask you, was he in West Germany or was he in East Germany? I know they don't specify.
I know.
I feel like West.
I mean, yeah.
Well, I would argue that, you know, perhaps... You know, and this goes to the, again, so the thing that foils it is I think he was in East Germany as a spy and then just defected because a lot of, you know, stories at the time were about that. And
that's something actually we should maybe address, that the East and West Germany were very separate.
Yes.
That was, you know, the wall was still up in place at this point.
Very much so.
I had to explain this to my roommate the other day. She's so
about
young.
About the Berlin Wall?
She did not understand, so.
Well, go ahead. I mean,
just post World War II, you know, Germany was divided. You had East and West Germany. The Berlin Wall was brought up, and one side was more democratic and going forward, while the other was more Soviet controlled.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why we see there is that concern in the prisoner, and why that's such an overarching problem is that you have to wonder what side of the quote-unquote Iron Curtain you fall on. Are you with or against the Soviets?
And it was always interesting to me how much the idea of just one wall could be, you know, represented not only Berlin, but then Germany, and then the world.
Yeah,
right.
You know, and so very much so like the village, yes, we're on a, you know, everything's local, but it's not. It goes beyond just local.
Right.
So.
But yeah, so Cobb being East German, or in East Germany and defecting, could be a strong possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's, you know, it's interesting, you know, I think for the purposes of time, I think mm-hmm. this is ultimately why they did it was, you know, we're kind of taken through this hospital, and we see the gibberish and whatever else. We see the means that they're willing to go mm-hmm. to you know, try to break someone, and then we find out that there's been a suicide.
Hmm. We're told there's a suicide.
Yeah.
Yes.
Clearly,
yes.
Cobb is not dead.
And by the way, in the original script, the lines were reversed because the doctor says, what happened? Mm-hmm. You know, he fell out the whatever it is, right? And the lines were in the original script were reversed.
Oh. Mm. Look at you over there.
So.
He's
I don't know.
He's got them all right there.
Oh, yeah. I've got, but if you guys want, mm-hmm. There's a link, again, in the description of all the scripts, the order, you know, you guys are going to make the order. But it took me a long time, and I was able to buy the Prisoner script books. So if you're interested in that, just look it up online, go to the, you know, and there's a few copies still left. When I was doing it, it was not as easy to find these things.
Wow.
So, I always wanted the actual physical book, but the other scripts are actually free, so you can check those out.
I'm like amazed at how into this you are. I mean, I get it. I watched one episode and did, you know, some research, a few hours of research, and I get it and I understand it, but I just.
Well, part of it
cute,
is,
Phil.
You know, part of it is, number one, Meredith and I have never hosted,
yeah.
right? So right. if I'm gonna, and so I wanted her to, you know, I didn't want to let her down, right? And I wanted to like,
no, I love it.
Level.
I have so much respect for you, and I love when people geek out.
I know. Yeah. And then number two, you know, I knew if we were gonna do this, I could not and would not do a disservice. That's why it mm-hmm. took me a long time to find Meredith.
Right.
And then, you know, and then when you came along, I knew you would have a respect for it.
Right.
That even if you hadn't seen the episodes, you would still appreciate it and things like that. And so, I knew, you know, cause again, there's so many fans that love this
yeah.
that it would be a huge disservice. It would be a spit in their face to just say like, oh yeah, here we are. You know, we've done no research whatsoever.
Right,
and
right, we're
just
right.
talking about
and guys, like true story, I was living in Atlanta at the time and, suddenly I passed out and woke up here in the studio. So, I mean, that's how Phil found me.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. True
it
story.
Was, it was a calling.
Sometimes we hear things over the loudspeaker too.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of new friends, our new number two, right? So this
yes.
is this is something that that establishes itself for coming weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't, you know, sorry to spoil it for everybody in that sense, but you know, again, it's presenting these things so you're not weirded out in future episodes that
right.
there's going to be a number two if something fails.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and he walks back in demanding answers, and lo and behold, there's a new man sitting in number two's chair. And it's just like, I mean, it's jarring. It's like, you expect to see someone, and now it's not that person. And they still, like, no, I'm number two now. You accept it and move on.
Right.
And what is that you know, for
so
you?
So clearly, for me, so clearly that number two, it's not like the three of us arrived, and it's like number one, two, three, and that sticks with you. It's number two is a... like a job. You know what I mean? Like yep. it's a placement yeah. in this, I want to say government because it seems like government to me, just like a place in this government. Like he's the vice president. You know yep. what I mean? Or whatever mm-hmm. they would say. And so it doesn't matter. That doesn't stick, which again shows the lack of individuality. It's like you don't even, not only are you not a person, but you don't even get to keep your number.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's just where you fit in that day of mm-hmm. what's happening, what course of events happened. That's, you know,
and very
what
much
you're called.
You know, and each person represents a different tactic of how to mm-hmm. go about certain things. And,
right.
you know, I believe you'll learn more about the tactics of number twos later. This, you know, you don't quite know because it's not, you know, we don't really spend yeah. too much time with number two particularly. We just know it's a different person.
Right.
And they both fail.
Yeah. But, right. but again, it's another good way of disinformation and making you feel on it, like, you know, taking away your sense of security. You know, you had this one relationship with this one person, now suddenly that is gone, and now you it further is with the brainwash, you know, falls
right.
in line with the brainwashing.
Yeah,
absolutely. How funny would it be if we came back next week and we had new hosts? New
I'd
host all
sad.
Around
we can new... just all wear wigs.
Yeah, well, we
that
might
be
do
the, funny.
The new panel.
We'll just wear t-shirts with the number on it and just switch them around, depending.
All right. And so, you know, after meeting the new number two, we're as angry as can be after this, but we meet, you know, we go, the idea of, we'll talk about the idea of funeral and life and death and all that, but here is where we meet number nine, who, for all intents and purposes, is the exact opposite of number six, right? Six flipped is nine.
Right.
He's male, she's female. He's on one side, she's, we don't quite know.
I'm sorry, I don't know if you guys got this, and I don't know if it plays at all, but when we are introduced to her, it looks like she's wearing a Snow White outfit.
Okay.
Like she, okay.
I don't know if that plays, but if you, if
but go,
you
go with it.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, you could see in that outfit, like in the back, it's very Snow White esque. So is there?
Hmm.
I don't know. I don't know if that. I don't know if the time frame of when Snow White was established. But for me, as soon as I saw that, I was like, Princess Snow White. I'm like, what's the subliminal? Someone getting poisoned? Like, what's happening?
You could
see,
be
like,
right.
The show makes you question everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
It did, and I was like, how does this play? And it's not, you know, she wasn't in, like, all the men seem to be dressed somewhat country club-esque, you know what I mean? And then she's got this, like, poofy Snow White coat on. I don't know, I couldn't let go of the Snow White.
Fair enough. There's no Seven Dwarves.
No.
But here's the thing. Well,
maybe.
No, I will say you're right. I mean, what's most intriguing to me is that you haven't seen the other episodes, and yet you're already questioning poison because you know, this isn't a spoiler because the interesting part is how it happens. There will be methods of brainwash and poisons and drugs and things like that.
See, I'm paying attention.
So that, but the fact that you picked that up without us, you know, feeding it to you.
Yeah.
You know, that's kudos to the show for setting up so many weird things.
Yeah.
Anything else about, you know, I guess the question would be, as this develops, did you believe her motives? Did you trust her? Was she at the very least somewhat genuine, but perhaps afraid?
Well, it's harder because, I mean, given we'd already been shown a woman who was willing to cry on demand to get what she wanted, and run back to number two. The one thing that was interesting was her belying the romantic relationship she had with Cobb, which again is an opposite from number six because he will never, you know, as we'll learn. But I feel like she did come across a lot more sincere in her motives.
Mm.
But I don't trust anyone though.
Yeah,
I don't know that I trusted her either.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to, and then when she was talking to him and she was like, here's the helicopter, here's the watch, I was like, something's fishy. And is it, I don't know if I just missed this or didn't pick this up, but are the men all even numbers and the women odd numbers? Does that play at all?
I'm not going to answer that. Mm-hmm. That's something, no, but that's a good question explore.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, and you know what? Let's see if it holds true for next episode, and then if it continues on, we'll see.
Okay.
That's a good question.
I did my homework.
I mean, you know, the prisoner says, you know, how did you come to get it and things like that, and she says Cobb, and I think, was it a mistake that perhaps that Cobb or you know, the prisoner number six put a lot of weight and trust on Cobb?
I mean, when you're thrown into a situation where everything you know is turned upside down, the one familiar face, it's going to be the thing that kind of cracks you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the one thing, and that you are. It's like, okay, here's that slice of normality. Here's this one thing I can identify with. Here is me for the first time actually saying like a name, and I think that was. That's a bug. like a little bug. Like
it's,
they're
it's
listening
a spy.
To us. It is.
It is.
But I think with number six, he was put into a position where he had no other choice but to trust Cobb.
Well, that was set up perfectly by them.
Yeah.
You know, and especially because, you know, in that way, like if you're from his perspective, if the only way that you can withhold information is to commit suicide, then you kind of become trusting of the fact that, wow, he... You know, he wasn't going to tell.
Right.
Yeah.
So, obviously not the case.
No.
He did not. He did not. But, interesting enough, so, okay, so to that point, right, kind of in terms of the helicopter escape and things like that, as number two is talking with number nine, there's no indication that she knows that it wasn't, you know, for her purposes, it's still very real. Cobb is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so does that change your idea of number two, knowing what you, or not, I'm sorry, not number two, number nine, knowing that Cobb is still alive and she was manipulated as well?
No, I just think it's more of a bigger plan. Mm-hmm. I just think they're playing her.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think she's going to, you know, I mean, from this episode, I don't get the impression that she is also part of the wheel, part of the mm-hmm. cog, if you will. But, you know, it's easier, the more people who buy into the truth that's given to them, it's going to be easier for them to play their parts. So even if she is ultimately on the side of the village, she doesn't need to know everything to play mm-hmm. her role out.
Yeah. So there's the, you know, there's the helicopter escape. He's got everything. Rover's not going after him. And one of the more interesting parts of this is that, you know, they edited it in such a way. Originally it wasn't intended this way, but they edited it so that the helicopter's kind of going off into the distance. And there she is looking at it. And here's our ex-admiral. You want to play chess? I don't know how to play. We're all pawns, honey. Yeah. Take a seat.
Yeah.
And I like that they, you know, you saw that in the editing process and were like, okay, we can juxtapose this to create some sort of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you guys want to give it a certain meaning? I mean, for a little bit, you can say like, oh, it's pretty on the level. We are all pawns.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was just to reestablish that they're all some way, shape, or form getting played, and that they're not only, like, if you think about the game of chess, the pawn is the least valuable player, so to speak. Yeah. So I feel like that's, you know, if one goes down, you know, you still got a lot of other that are exactly the same, that can do exactly the same job, which is, again, only move one step, unless it's the first step, of course. But you know what I mean?
To that interesting point, right, this may or may not be a foreshadow, right? While it is the least valuable, if it crosses a certain threshold,
you get another player.
You get whatever you want.
Yeah.
You can have the queen. You can have...
Ultimately, right, the pawn is like the most disposable, but also one of the most powerful pieces in chess.
So that's interesting to know.
Well, is that him a little bit thinking out of the box? That like if they all rallied together, they could change something? Or is that just crazy?
I almost feel like the Admiral is a strange, like, I don't want to say oracle character, but he definitely fills a trope of the omnipotent character. He kind of knows more than the rest of the viewers do, and I think he's, you know, there's something about that that's really intriguing.
Yeah, he's been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like, he's been around the block, is what I get from him a couple times, or around the village.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, and then kind of the last part is the helicopter comes back and Cobb is revealed. Yeah. For you, what was that moment?
Well, for me, number one, the helicopter scene was...
You didn't see number one.
Huh?
It's a joke.
For me, the first thing was the helicopter scene, again, was such a play to technology today. The fact that they were taking over the controls was very, you know, drone-like, or the things that are happening today, it was just, it seemed to me like, how could that happen back in the day? Like, clearly it probably couldn't, but now how everything's automatic and you're not really in charge of where you think you're going was very strong for me. And I did like that there was the reveal of Cobb, but I kind of wasn't shocked. Like, I feel like when I saw him, I was like, okay, that makes sense. Like, it made sense that he was who number six saw, who jumped out the window, who committed suicide, who died for number nine. Like, he clearly has more of a key role in this, and I'm excited to see what that is. But I was kind of excited to see him. Because I don't know. I want to feel like he's kind of a good guy.
Well, he says Avidazane, so I don't know.
Yeah. Red herrings there, like when they say au revoir and Avidazane. It's like, wait, are we not in England? Because maybe I thought this was the British government. Maybe this isn't. Maybe this is the Germans.
Someone's got to be in there, though, to help him.
Well, we'll find out. So far, it hasn't happened. I mean, the last shot is, you know.
We got 17 episodes. He's got to make, someone's got to turn on his side.
Well, yeah, well, you know, whose side is that? His own.
Right. So,
true.
And himself. The iconic, the prison bars come up, mm-hmm. his face, where he is the prisoner.
Just in case you didn't get that from the whole episode, they really wanted to hit home with that. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. No, but I you know, as cheesy as it may be, mm-hmm. I certainly enjoy it because it's just this nice symbolic
yeah.
thing. And it is so hard-hitting and comedic,
mm-hmm.
but good.
Yeah.
So. Right.
All right. So we've gotten kind of, you know, beat by beat overall through the episode. So now we can kind of take it more, you know, a higher up perspective. Mm-hmm. We can talk about the questions and the themes. And, you know, so a couple of questions that this thing raises, and if you guys want to answer any of them, feel free to jump in, or I can just list them off. Where's the village? Right? What is the village? Whose side is number six on? Whose side is the village on? What methods is the village willing to employ? Who can number six trust? We were just talking about that. How can number six escape? Who is number one? Will number six escape? When? How? Why did number six resign? Any of these jump at you that you just want to start maybe tackling based off of this episode?
It's okay. So the whole what side is the village on? I keep going back to, is this Britain's home for spies? Is this how they're going to declassify and decommission and keep them in a place where no other country,
like a safe house,
like a safe house in a way, and
wow.
just put them there so they don't have to worry about other other countries getting a hold of them? Or is this just such an elaborate plot by the communists that they have already infiltrated parts of the British government, that they've recreated a British town to try to like extract information, and maybe number six is the only one and everyone else's players on this stage? I mean, from the first episode, these are things that I would question.
So you're thinking, maybe could this be a place where they're like, could they could the intention be to keep number six safe of something?
No,
who knows?
Perhaps. I mean, to me, the intriguing part is, you know, I like the idea of trying to figure out who number one is.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's called The Prisoner, you have to question, okay, he didn't escape in this episode. Is he, and when is he, and how is he going to escape? Right?
No.
I don't think...
You know, and this might be so far-fetched and wrong, but you think about shows with titles like The Prisoner, and it's like, at the end of the day, is it going to be flipped that he's his own prisoner because of stuff that's happened to him? Is it going to be flipped that he's... I don't know. Like, I feel like there's... The Prisoner and him being in prison in this village is just too... There's going to be way more layers to that.
Absolutely. You know, and in terms of the production design, what was really cool, everyone's always wearing stripes, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I.e. they're like jail. Prisoners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, also that one of the things about the costume design, you know, you see it in the umbrella and you see it in the women's cloaks, almost like if they started twirling those stripes, they would turn into a very hypnotic type device. And so that kind of furthers the idea of hypnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I like that. So I guess while we're kind of talking about that, you know, we've hinted at it a little bit, but the idea of Big Brother always watching you, and, you know, there was we'll talk about the actual setting, but, you know, the statues that they had, they used it to their advantage of, like, putting eyeballs in there, i.e. the cameras and, you know, the control room. And, you know, we joked about it, but the idea of be seeing you, you know.
Also, well, they said that when they were VSN.
Yeah.
You know, that's their little, like, they know we're watching.
Yeah.
They're always watching.
Always. It's kind of creepy.
No, it is. No, but you know, I think, Steph, what's drawing you to this show is that how it relates, you know, years after the show has been made, it still relates. I mean, more so, right? I think New York had an article about this. London probably had an article about this. But 10,000 hidden cameras found. Okay, those are just the ones that were found.
Right, yeah.
How many are there really?
Well, I mean, we already know that CCTV, the British network, like, is established and linked across, you know, main cities in London and so forth that watches its citizens. And, I mean, you know, the red light cameras and stuff.
See, I don't hate that stuff. That doesn't make me...
Well, I think, because it's like, I'm not doing anything wrong, so I'm not concerned.
Right, and if God forbid something happened to me and they could... see it on camera, awesome.
Yeah, but to that same point, you know, if I'm walking down the street and picking my butt, I don't want that. You know what I mean? Like,
there's like elements of
grossness that you don't want seen. I mean,
they're not gonna like be like, oh, there's Phil picking his wedge. Let's put that up on TMZ. Like, who cares?
Everybody does. Okay, take it. I'm gonna argue against you because now, right? There's so many. What's like the latest thing? Memes, right? Mm-hmm. So someone will take a picture from the internet that they have no affiliation towards and make a joke out of it.
Yeah.
Putting text over it.
Okay,
who cares?
But going to modern time up here and now, we put so much of our lives out there for everyone to see because of social media. Like, who cares
on
what
purpose.
Big brother is watching?
Yeah.
Like, I say more dumb stuff when I'm drunk and tweeting than what like government will ever find out about me.
That's what I'm. Yeah, I feel like it's kind of an oxymoron almost about how we don't want to be surveillanced yet mm-hmm. we want to like tell the world like went to the bathroom today. I'm feeling sad. Come on.
It's
technology being used for the good, and I can't handle
it. Everyone needs to know what I had for lunch, okay?
You know what? Philip K. Dick used to write a letter, the story goes, a letter a day to the government, and eventually he was like, I want everything you have on me, and they just sent him a box of all of his letters. So, again, but it's one of those things, you know, I think ultimately you just have to define what things are for you, and as long as you have a purpose and a meaning behind it, I want to ask you guys.
That's the big thing with all this purpose and meaning behind it, with media, whether it be them, you know, surveillancing us or us putting ourselves out there. A lot of people are lacking that purpose or meaning, and they need that validation by other people. So that's why they play technology mm-hmm. the way that they do now, which I think is very different from the way they're using technology back then.
Yeah.
They weren't validating. They were trying to spy on people, which is different.
And technology now helps us define our individuality, where technology back then was uncertain and threatening in a lot of ways because people didn't know what it was. They didn't know what was coming.
Yeah. And we have a photo, you know, speaking of technology, right? So here's a techie timeline.
Oh, my God.
Did you draw this yourself?
I had one of my friends, you know, draw it. No, I didn't. I'll give credit for it.
Where's Nintendo?
So this is strictly the progression of kind of, you know, it begins with the calculator, right? And it progresses into single computing and blah, blah, blah. But the idea of these things start for the purpose of one person and then now grow to be, again, with the internet, global. Right, and it just kind of expands that way to the point that now we're tweeting again. This is what I had for lunch, and so what starts off as good intention, and I want to kind of tie this back into on the bee seeing you, if nothing else, mm-hmm. because I read that the symbol of bee seeing you was originally started by Christians, and I have no further research or whatever
wow.
beyond that. So yeah. I wanted to ask you guys about that because in this way, right, Christianity. Whatever you think of it, I think ultimately was created for the sense of good. Now, people have, you know, people still can be good, or mm-hmm. others you have used it to an idea of bad, you know, for their own intentions, and we can debate that forever. But
we could totally debate that forever. Real quick, I just want to say something else about the techie timeline. I promise it'll be really quick. I think that because we've all lived in the age where we've seen the progression of technology gives us a certain perspective. Like if 20 years from now people were watching this show, I don't think they would think maybe talking over loudspeakers or being surveillanced would matter as much because they're so used to it. Like we've seen it go from it not being that way to it being this tech way.
Okay, but then how would you guys rate or view so let's say the Industrial Revolution with that's like newspapers are being printed and you're like, that's not like, do you say that's not cool? Or you're like, oh wow, I'm intrigued by this because I'm learning this is how it used to be.
I just don't think kids nowadays would care. Like, I don't think they would care to know about a newspaper. You think so?
No, I'm laughing because I sadly agree with you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I think it's super sad, but
yeah.
Like, these kids don't know. They don't care. They're so used to this instant gratification.
There's the sense of entitlement.
Right. So the fact that they're spying on someone to know what they're doing, I don't think will faze them as much as it might, you know, get conversation from us because we've seen this movement, whatever you want to call it, happen.
In more ways, modern technology is doing more to diminish and abolish our sense of individuality than what was happening to number 6 in The Prisoner.
Exactly. Okay, sorry. We'll go back to Christianity. We'll just start
we're already going that way. I mean, hey, I don't know if you guys have the origin of the symbol of bee seeing you, so we can...
I don't know. I was raised by a wild pack of atheists, so I have very little input on that.
Yeah, I'm not the churchgoer.
If you guys watching or listening, let us know, because, again, I could not find further information upon that. Or at least maybe I just didn't try hard enough for this episode.
Well, it also is interesting that a lot of this is very, and I might get hate for this, but I'm just going to say it. A lot of this village is very religion-like. You know, I feel like if you think about religion, like every religion answers the same questions, like where do we come from? Where do we go when we die? Where, how do we feel better? Like just, and I feel like that in a certain sense puts a false security on people so that they don't think outside the box. And I feel like that's what's happening here as well.
And, you know, so, okay, so now let's go back to technology, right? Alexis, bring up that wonderful photo right there, the Gap photo. And no, we're not talking about the Gap, the clothing store.
Mind the Gap.
But here, you know, okay, so we're looking at this, right? And so in terms of there's a necessity for Christianity, and we feel like there's a necessity for technology to better our lives, right? And even in everyday, for me, I look at it like, okay, how can this be done better? And there must be a better way.
But what does better mean to you? Better to most people, like better to me means it would create more thought from people. It will create all this stuff. Better to a lot of people now means quicker, faster, easier. And I don't know that that's necessarily better.
And that's true. So the thing that we're looking at, right, the amount of features that something has continues to increase. The amount of features we actually use it for, you know, it's not decreasing, but you could say it's pretty much, you know, I would argue that in some sense you should draw a decreasing line there.
I agree with you. And it is. It's the whole, I mean, it goes very back to a simple conversation of a quantity versus quality. I mean, you can find all kinds of stuff online now, but how is it good? I mean, even if you think about a TV show, it's like back in the day, and we're doing one right now, so it's like a little bit like hypocritical.
It's a bit meta.
Right, but in the same sense, it's like back in the day, it's like you had a TV show, you had an idea, you had to tell somebody. That somebody then thought it was a good idea, and you had to tell somebody else. And that somebody thought it was a good idea, and then you got to pitch that idea. Now it's just like, all right, let's just put a camera on ourselves, and we got a TV show.
So hey, I pitched her the idea, and I pitched you the idea. And there's some work involved.
Right, but a lot of people aren't. They're going on, you know what I mean? I'm just saying there's a lot of other ways to get, you know, featured and stuff. That's why I think it's the decline of good content.
And where do you stand on this, Meredith?
It's hard. I think the more technology progresses, we as consumers can choose to consume what we want. You know, 20 years ago, I was limited to watching the channels that cable or network had. I was limited to the news that like a particular station decided to give me. Now I can go out and read what I want. I can read news from Al Jazeera. I can read news from BBC. I can read news from, you know, South African outlets. But that being said, the ability to consume what we want is also dangerous because then we can only choose to consume things that adhere to our own beliefs and practices. Yeah. So we're no longer, I feel like, We're all, you know, the way modern media is it's almost doing ourselves a disservice because we're not thinking outside of the box. We're just taking whatever we want spoon fed to us that makes life pretty.
Yeah, you're finding information to support your own argument.
And I feel like the amount of thought that you just put into that, 80% of the population doesn't. They're just like, oh, this thing made me laugh. Cool, let's like it.
Well, here's
Here's
what I will say. You know,
it could be good, but it's almost like everything. It's like it could be good, but it's like you think about alcohol. You know, like it. Some people like a glass of wine with their meal; it makes it taste better. But then you have the people But then you have the people that like 10, but go out and drive and go out and do these things that are disruptive. You know what I mean? Like the idea of technology is not bad. It's that it's the users that use it, not for. I think what its intended purpose was.
I'm just going to make the correlation up. I'm sorry. Oh God. Wally. Mm-hmm. That's where we're going. Like with everything spoon fed and making our lives so easy and thoughtless. Like not in terms of like I'm being rude, but I don't have to think about where I'm getting stuff from. We're going to be those overweight people in those floating chairs sucking down our Slurpees. Like that.
Right. And then the internet's going to go down for a week and people are going to lose their freaking minds.
Okay, come on. When Facebook goes down for 30 minutes,
people lose their minds.
CNN is reporting on it, okay?
They're not going to know how to read a map. They're not going to know how to go anywhere. They're not going to know how to do any simple multiplication or mathematics. Like, they don't make people think anymore. And the problem solving and why people get so mad when they don't get their way is because I believe the problem solving element of education is not really there anymore because you don't need it. You just need Google.
So let me.
Sorry, I could go on and on.
No.
Sorry, no. Yeah, go
I'm gonna. I'm gonna kind of give my final thoughts. And again, this is. We're not gonna. Yeah, I'm sure we'll continue this argument. No, you guys are fine. I will say this. One of the things I think, you know, people think that. To me, there's, and you can say this is perhaps a grim view, but I would think that it's not. No matter which way you slice and you dice it, right? You're always going to have a level of stress and conflict in your life, right? So if you choose to live a simpler life, then perhaps you're going to have to worry about what food you put on your table every day. If you don't have to worry about that, like you know you're going to get lunch and dinner today and you don't have to think about those things, your conflict is going to be on others. Like, what do I do with my free time and all this other stuff, right? So I think if you establish that in your life, then it's about choosing what to worship and things like that. So going back, no, there is in the everyday trenches of life, there is no such thing as atheism. You have to worship one thing or another, whether it's money, whether it's, whether it's a loved one, whatever, whatever these things may be as you define them. But I think the problem is you just have to be aware enough of what you choose and why you're choosing it instead of living your life on a default human setting.
And that's my biggest problem. I actually do my own show about that, and I actually the purpose is to ask people why they think the way they do, and 9 times out of 10 they have no idea. They just picked something up along the way and went with it. People don't think for themselves anymore, and they don't have to, and that's scary.
Absolutely,
Rover needs to go like bop some people in the head.
And again, unless anyone has any kind of closing thoughts, because again, this is something we'll continue to debate throughout.
Well, I just, my only thing is just bringing it back to the source material at hand is how, I want to say there's a, you have a note here that, there's never been a weapon we've made that hasn't been used. And the same can be said in The Prisoner that, and I don't want to give too much away, but, what level they'll go to employ to get information and to get people to fall in line. And I think, there is a cautionary tale of technology in The Prisoner. And I think that's something that we're going to see develop over future episodes.
That's a good, I'm glad you brought that up. And that, by the way, Patrick McGoohan said that quote.
Okay.
So I'll give it
I thought that was you. I thought that was Philip.
No? Unfortunately not.
Not a Phil Sweet.
Yeah.
You know what?
Original?
Not quite. It'll be years before I write my own.
The PSOs?
Let's talk about individualism versus society, right? Albertus was the font that was heavily used, and they made a specific choice in terms of the production design that there would not be a lot of capitals, if at all. I can't quite remember. Mm-hmm. So that way no one letter stood out. And I thought that was so interesting, just even down to the production design of individualism versus the society. So
it just, again, goes to strip away any sense of self.
You know, it's kind of weird. I'm really against capital letters in my life, so I wonder if somewhere... I don't ever really write capitals. Like my website, everything is just all lowercase.
Is it laziness?
No, it's, I don't like the way it looks, to be honest with you. It's like a design thing. Like The Prisoner like that, I think looks more aesthetically pleasing than more visually pleasing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Looking up at the.
Yeah. Like it looks way better.
So we're comparing the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog, Steph Z, which is the lazy dog. Doesn't want to recap. I'm kidding. And then we're looking at a lowercase version of that. So
not only did you call me a dog, you called me a lazy dog.
I love dogs.
All right, you do. Right. I love you too, Phil.
All right. So one of the things that we didn't talk about was the idea of death and funerals and the importance it has in this show. Obviously, when we're giving the tour of the village, we have our own graveyard, but you are going to be more interested in our social club. And then we see the funeral. It's very formulaic, but there's nothing behind it, except number 9 has a certain sense of affection to it, but, and Cobb does. But other than that, it's used more as a threat than like a ceremony of one's life.
Right. But if you don't have your own life, aren't you kind of dead anyway?
Ooh. Boom. Drop the mic, Steph Z. Meredith,
I can't even follow up with that. I mean, exactly. There's no I mean, the only thing I will say in regards to the graveyard is that I just want to know, did those people die of natural causes or?
I don't think so.
Yeah, how they got there.
Poison. I mean, yeah. Snow White did it.
Yeah.
With the poison in the dining room with the candlestick.
All right. As we're kind of getting towards the end of things, and you know, we'll try to readjust some things based off of how this goes and how you guys kind of react to it and things like that. So so bear with us. The first episode, we want to find our footing.
We give an extended
again. We don't want you guys feeling like we don't know our information, so we're making this one a little bit longer. So that way you guys are like, oh, these guys know what they're talking about. Good.
You shouldn't have to say that, Phil.
You know what?
No, just kidding.
You know what? I do have to say that.
Guys, please think we know what we're talking about.
I promise we at least watched the episode once.
Yeah.
Your favorite quotes. We already said the we're all pawns, your move, my dear. There's the iconic one, six of one, half a dozen of the other, which is obviously the society that's kind of helping support our cause. They're named after six of one.
Yeah, we kind of already used mine in a topic point, but the be seeing you is like, well, it was used so early on.
Sorry,
I love that.
Six of one, half dozen of the other. Six of one is the men, and half dozen of the other are the women, like the 7 to 12.
Could be.
I don't know. This men-woman number thing, I'm really like, I like numbers. I want to know.
It could be.
I
want to
figure it out.
You know what? And a still tongue makes a happy life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of like, shut the up.
Yeah, if you don't question anything, you won't have any problems here.
Yeah, I would not survive there. Because I question everything. Like, excuse me. Why is the ice cream coming now? Excuse me? I do. I ask less questions.
Maybe you might get some answers.
Maybe. Doubtful. Probably not the correct answers.
Mm-hmm. Definitely not the correct answers.
Just
might get
to
some
shut
answer.
Me up. Yeah.
All right. Any other quotes that jump out to you guys? I mean, obviously the show's very quotable.
Yeah.
You know?
Did we go for the big one?
Which one?
Now I'm messing it up because it's not for me.
I am not a number.
I am a man.
Yes. And we also get introduced, you know, I will not be stamped, filed, briefed, debriefed, indexed. And I don't know the exact order.
I know.
And I just spoke about how we were experts.
We're expert fans, but we're not machines who can quote everything. I'm really bad at that.
Yeah.
I have a limited memory bank. And unfortunately, and actually quotes are not one of my things. My boyfriend jokes that he has pop culture Tourette's because he can quote things from out of nowhere. And I'm like, I can't even quote what I just said.
Fair enough. And so now, we gave a little bit of context to the show. And so, you know, in hindsight, maybe we should have done this at the top, but who knows? Again, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Live and learn.
This is, Steph, I'm here to tell you how the show came into being.
You know what? Tell me. I'm all ears.
And,
tell me how it is.
And one of the things, by the way, as we talk about this, I don't want it to just be me spewing out fact and information, so do partake in the conversation.
I will ask questions if I have them.
So ITV was started in the 1950s. It was an alternate to the then monopoly of BBC in Britain, and the man who gets the credit is Lou Grade, right? So we're looking at a picture of him. And I try to find a picture with him and Patrick McGoohan or somebody from the show, but I couldn't. So he is the man on the right, for those of you, if you're looking at this picture.
Do you know who he's with?
I you know, it said it.
Oh, I'm just so curious.
You know what? That's it could be anybody.
Because I'm sorry, in my head, I actually want to believe that ITV was started by a person of color in the 50s. And
it was not.
I know.
Unfortunately,
so
was not.
Thanks, Britain.
Very racist at the time still.
Just a bit.
And then ITC was the production company started by him to make all of these shows for ITV. So there we go. There's ITC Presents, and you know, as episodes go on, we'll kind of see that as part of it.
A little intertwined logo back and forth, run the straight and narrow in the middle.
That's right. Now this is where Meredith comes in because, so Danger Man, right? So Danger Man is Patrick McGoohan's show, started in the 1960s. It actually beat James Bond to the screen, right? So in terms of, so this we're talking about kind of in the spy genre. Danger Man was a spy genre.
Mm-hmm.
And again, came out, you know, and Patrick McGoohan there was debate. They wanted him as a James Bond character, but it was not to be. He didn't want to do it.
He is an attractive man, though. I just have to throw that out there. He's got that spy look. When, like, watching that, I was like, oh, man, I forgot it.
I bet you if look. I bet you if you would take a picture of him and show it to 100 women, at least 80 of them would say that, like, who is this? They'd say James Bond.
Yep. Yeah, mm-hmm. He just has that
He has that look. Yeah.
So Meredith, speak to us about Danger Man. You know, you've seen every episode, most of the episodes.
I've seen enough that, you know, so Danger Man started, you know, it's a spy show, and McGoohan plays Agent Drake, and he's actually, he's a NATO spy. He's not with, like, MI6 or anything. He's actually a spy for NATO, and he kind of goes through, and his whole thing is that he does not believe, and the actor, McGoohan, does not believe in violence or sex on TV. There's a great quote that you brought up that was, you know, television is a guest in people's homes, and he wanted that to show through in his show. And so everything that he solves is through technology and wits, which really, to me, is the pinnacle of a good spy novel. You don't need to be a brute force to get your way. You don't have to go assassinate people. You just have to solve your mystery through your mind. And Danger Man was great at that. It was, you know, kind of opened up the world for what we saw with, you know, Get Smart and other, you know, subsequent shows from that, out of that time period. And the thing with McGoohan is, can I go ahead and jump to, like, Prisoner started, is he got bored. He kind of got tired of doing the show after so many years. He's like, hey, guys, I'm over this. I want to be done with this. So he pitched the idea of The Prisoner, and Lou Grade said, it's just so crazy it might work. And they actually gave Patrick McGoohan carte blanche, creative control, to work on the show. And he, you know, worked on it, and this is what we got. I'm trying to remember. He had the writer from the
So one of the, you know, so speaking of carte blanche, you know, what was interesting to me was that there was no official deal in place, right? And I always love it when, you know, there's that old school business of, like, we just shook hands. We have a deal in place. Like, what do you mean paperwork? We just talked about it. We shook hands. That should be enough. And, you know, even whatever you think of Donald Trump, he actually still adheres to that mentality to a degree. And what was even more interesting is that, you know, here there was presentations, there was boards, there were scripts and treatments and all this. And he was like, throw it out. Just tell Pat, what do you want? What is the show? Just tell me the show, and that's it. I want to know the show, not this. And that's how it came to be.
Wow. Yeah.
And by the way, so, you know, one of the things that you'll find interesting, Steph, obviously still to this day, and as we continue, we'll talk about the behind the scenes of certain feuds and things like that, but still to this day, there's debate whether John Drake, the character in Danger Man, which was called a secret agent in the U.S. and inspired the song Secret Agent Man.
Wow.
See? A little bit of history for you.
Mm-hmm. I like it. You know what, too? To speak to the carte blanche of, like, scenario, again, it's amazing to me that when you have one person with a brilliant idea and you let him run with it, something like this, again, a show that we're talking about so much later can happen. I mean, if you think about television now, there's so many moving parts and there's so many cooks in the kitchen. You know what I mean? Like, I love that. I didn't know that till, you know, you guys just said it.
But at the same time, he was the highest paid actor at the time in Britain. Again, he was up for the role of Bond. So there was, so, you know what I mean? He had a certain track record.
But I'm just saying, like, it goes to show that the human nature back in the day, which I feel like we've lost a little bit of, is that handshake, is that trust, is that if I say I'm going to deliver something amazing, I'm not going to try and cheap out or, you know, figure out, you know, the quickest, easiest, cheapest way to make money. He actually gave a crap and wanted to make a good series.
Well, and because it was essentially ending the most popular program on air at the time by him saying, you know, I'm done, I want out. And they could have been like, no, you have to go through with this contract and go X amount of, you know, years on this. And they're like, all right, no, we'll give you your out. And in hindsight, it's interesting to think about, since Patrick McGoohan also stars in The Prisoner, is The Prisoner Agent Drake, is this show actually in a weird way, like, self-referential to him and leaving that role.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, first, because, again, he resigned from
mm-hmm. Danger Man. He resigns here, and again, is he resigning as John Drake? It's, you know, Wolf, yeah. You know,
it's very. So wait, I have a question that might be so not right, but is him resigning from Danger Man have anything to do with how they started this series with him resigning?
That's what we're just saying. We actually don't. Yeah, that's the debate. That's actually one of the longest held debates because it's never. I don't want to spoil anything, but it's never. We'll find out. But it's
yes. It's like he resigned from this thing that worked to do this other thing where maybe he felt like he was a prisoner because he had to deliver this new thing that's better than the old one.
Interesting. Yeah. That's a nice little parallel. You know, so going in here in the links provided for you guys in terms of the scripts, you won't find this, but here's a kind of a story information, right? So I'll try to read some of the more interesting ones. It's always us or them. And this is in the treatment, by the way. He awakens in the village. Who is the prisoners? Who are the captors? Who then runs the village? Is it east or west? In any event, he is a prisoner. Action is always happening on three levels. Our hero is constantly probes to discover why he is a prisoner and who his captors are. He strives by all means and at risk of death to escape. He becomes involved with his captors and takes an active part in situations arising in their lives, which that's an interesting one. Mm-hmm. And then it gives a full kind of description of all the various things of the village. So geography, communications, the name, transport, shopping, currency, inmates, industry, hospital, surveillance, amusements, death, the key buildings, right? So we know there's the labor exchange, the citizens advice bureau, town hall, palace of fun.
I want to go.
The hospital and the open air cafe. It has its own newspaper, of course, and TV and radio.
Wow.
So that was all part of a 40-page treatment.
Wow.
That McGowan was thrown out, they had to throw out during the pitch.
He was like, he was as well researched as you were about this, and then having to throw out because we ramble. Not Steph ramble. I'm sorry. I'm really excited about everything we're talking about. What'd you find?
I just read that each episode had a budget of 75,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is roughly about $68,000.
In the 60s.
And to give you context, right? Again, so you're looking at it like, you know, in today's day and age, that's not a lot. That was $35,000 above the average of an ITC.
No, I thought it was a lot.
And it is.
Yeah.
They put a lot. I mean, I'm sure like, you know, location itself wasn't cheap to secure, but you know, and then how much of that budget is for McGowan himself?
He only took 5,000
really?
An episode. Only 5,000 an episode, yeah.
And then local actors got paid what, two pounds
a day?
2 pounds a day.
So that's like $4 a day.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So definitely, and you know, while we're kind of on that, they literally went 7 days a week for 16-hour days.
And it was, two rounds of 4-week shoots. So they completed the entire 17 episodes in eight weeks?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was for the exterior shots. And, and an average day, right? For those of you who know filmmaking, it's called setups, right? Every time you, you know,
change
something, it's a setup. So average back then, and still kind of to this day, was about 15. They did 33 in a day.
Hustling.
You know, they had to.
Man.
Yeah.
That's insane.
So, and we made note of other people joined in, right? Mm-hmm. So, there's David Tomlin, who, in 1960 formed Everyman Films with Patrick McGowan in the intent that they were going to make films, right? But that never happened. And so their first production was actually The Prisoner. So it took 6 years down line for this company to actually get a production deal. But the more interesting people were, I'm never going to be able to say these names, Don Chaffee and George Markstein.
Mm-hmm.
And Don had, by this point, he had directed about 20 movies or so. George Markstein, as we go on, his story will become more and more interesting because this doesn't spoil the show, but they had creative differences.
Yeah. Now, what was Markstein's role again? And was he?
He was the story editor, right?
Okay.
And so when you look at a title like that today, it doesn't mean a lot. But back then, like, there was so much weight held on a story editor. You know, and Don and Mark and George get the credit of writing Arrival. Now, it's said heavily that Pat McGowan rewrote a lot of it, but they are the ones credited with writing it. And at the time, George Markstein, he was a journalist before this for Stars and Stripes, the U.S. Army magazine. And he makes a there's a photo that Alexis has right there that that in the opening sequence, right, the man that is being yelled at, that is George. So he makes his little cameo, and it's ironic now post fact of the full history because spoiler.
Oh, I see the village. No, I'm kidding.
Yes, world. Indeed. So there you kind of have it. Any sort of thoughts on this, even though it's, you know, more fact than anything else?
Well, I think it'll come into play, like you said, later on when we start uncovering the creative differences behind the scenes, because it is definitely something that comes into play later.
Yeah. And Don and George worked on Danger Man. Don more so than he was a director. George became a story editor towards the end of it. And going back to Danger Man, episode...
We need to screen Danger Man.
We will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to see it now.
Yeah.
Like yesterday.
Well, specifically this episode, right? So in season one, episode three, it's called Colony 3. Have you seen this episode?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a description for it, but I'd rather hear your description of this episode because people cite this as...
it's going to be hard because I'm just going to go off script because it's been... I saw it when I was a kid. But we kind of have the idea of where the prisoner comes from in this episode. And it's so early on. And, Drake is actually taking the place of a defector and going over to... Was it East Germany?
I don't know.
I don't remember. No. I don't even remember if it was East Germany or if it was Russia at the time. So he's going in as a spy to go to this facility where there is an area that they train agents to become English, which I love in watching Agent Carter. They have the whole Red Room thing.
Yes.
That's what it reminded me of. So basically what happens is he finds this replica of an English village, and all these foreign agents are being trained in the ways of, like, proper, here's our tea time, here's when we do this, this is our accents, and his whole goal there is to disrupt the flow of this and stop these agents from entering England, which, if that hadn't been disrupted or there were other facilities around the time, what if this is all bringing him back into that village? But that episode right there is kind of where the whole idea of the prisoner came
it's
from.
It's kind of funny, though, that you actually mentioned Agent Carter in this, because if you think about Agent Carter and, like, the Marvels, the cinematic universe, and, like, all these things, it's like one, you know, Agent Carter, they all kind of coincide their storyline, or they share storylines, or they add pieces so that you do that. So I wonder, like, it seems to me, hearing, you know, about Danger Man being new to the prisoner, that there's a lot of things that can reference back and forth to each other. So if you're a fan of one, you'd be that fan that, you know, like, the show stands on its own. Like, Agent Carter stands on its own if you haven't watched, you know, any of the other shows. But if you have, then you're like, oh, that was in this. That person did that. That's why this.
And you'll see other reoccurring characters from Danger Man popping up in The Prisoner. Not reoccurring, but, like, you know, references. And then for a television show at that time, this is actually really unique to have a spinoff, if you will. Because in my headcanon, Prisoner is a spinoff of Danger Man. And that is how I perceive the shows, is that number six is Drake. And that is how I choose to view the history of everything.
So you gotta watch it.
I choose to view it that way too, you know, because the good news is it doesn't take away, but it adds.
Yeah,
right.
And the same with what you're saying with the Marvel MCU and everything.
Sweet.
So let's talk about this location again. It isn't revealed until the very end, but it very much became.
Don't tell me.
You don't want to know.
Oh, just, like, specifically
the filming,
where they
filming location. Okay.
The filming location.
Yeah, I don't want any spoilers.
And I don't know how to fully pronounce this, but Port Merion in North Wales was the location used as a village. It was inspired because, you know, they were there for Danger Man a couple of years, I believe in 62 is when they officially were there.
Wow.
And so, you know, a couple of years later, it was like, okay, this would be the place to shoot. And William Ellis...
William Zellis, he built this, and he started in 1925 building this, and it wasn't until 1973 that it actually got completed. And so, going back to Meredith's point about the two different shoots, if you really pay attention, the village changes.
Yeah.
Just because they're continuing to build.
So is this village, do you know, like, how does it stand today? Is it now a resort getaway?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can go visit. Okay. We can go visit the village.
So much so that...
Mm-hmm. So this, literally, we're doing our last episode from there. Sweet, love it.
April 17th, there's the meetup by the Six of One Society, and the special guest is Darren Nesbitt, who plays the new number two in It's Your Funeral.
Oh.
So, you know, not only can you visit it, there's stuff happening there.
It's like a VillageCon.
Yeah, every year there's someone there.
Oh my god, we should go to the VillageCon.
It's totally a VillageCon. We should just start that event.
I know.
And then we can wind up getting a lot of people to pay to go, and it will pay for us to go.
That's how it works.
I bet let's take donations. Let's see if the fans are out
there. If you guys think we should go to the VillageCon, the biggest donator gets to come with us. If you pay for all of us to go, you get to come.
Exactly. We'll just ride on your coattails.
Yeah.
I just think it would be amazing to do an... I'm getting ahead of myself. But yes, the village still stands today in its creepy, beautiful, brightly colored fashion with its green dome. Yeah. And it's a... And I'm not very familiar with England. I'm sorry, godparents. It's kind of like in a little like crevice in North Wales. Like, do we have a map? Actually,
we don't have a full map. We just have kind of pictures of.
We can't give away where the village is.
Yeah, you can't. Mm. But you're absolutely right. And then and the buildings themselves, they housed. You know, I mean, no production in Britain at this time went 2 miles outside of the company, right? Mm-hmm. And so these guys are going, I think, like 300 miles away. And they're shooting here, and so they're using the local actors, right? They're getting paid two a day. And the town hall is used as a production office. The actors are staying everywhere. And the local cinema is used for the dailies.
Which I found,
that's kind of awesome.
I found interesting.
Man, I thought extra work paid poorly now.
That was very much like, I mean, if you're there in North Wales, it's one of those things that you're just so happy to be.
It's
what
a
is
vacation,
this? I'll be
I
here.
Know.
Right.
It's gorgeous.
And the original butler was said to have no dialogue and was very athletically built. And this, we'll talk about how the butler takes on shape and meaning, but obviously he was not that. And
It's interesting how in the 60s they used a lot of little people to fill interesting roles. I mean, we see this with Indiana Jones. We see this in James. Do we see in a James Bond episode? No, I don't think so. Oh, no, I'm thinking DePlain, Boss DePlain. What movie is that? Got my brain stopped.
Fantasy Island.
Thank you. It's an interesting. I'm really big into tropes, and and it's interesting that they chose to go that route for this butler, which you know, it's they're playing on things that were popular at the time. I find. Sorry, I speak. I speak way too much about diversity in film and movies, and I love looking at how things were then versus now. So
yeah,
I don't do anything to offend people. Sorry. Yeah, that's just my thing.
All right.
It is, sister.
So, you know, we have a whole section of trivia that I think we'll forego for now. But in terms of the reception, you know, I always found it interesting that the MGM held a press conference, and here's Pat McGoohan, and unfortunately, Steph, you won't quite get this, but he came out in cowboy outfits behind bars and did this press conference.
Does he escape on a horse? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we don't know. But imagine this is built to you as a spy genre, right? So I'd build this to you very differently. Like, this is very highbrow entertainment. You know, you have to really think, and that's what drew you to it. But here, it's like, okay, here's a spy thing, and very much here's this cowboy behind bars. What is this?
Right.
You know, and this is before, you know, it's not like today where you have trailers online and things like that. Like, you just get this one bit of information and everyone's going to run with it. And so it's like, what is this?
Misinformation.
Misinformation.
Misdirection.
All right.
Oh, there's so much good trivia. We'll have to just get later on. Yeah.
We'll kind of figure out where it all fits. But, you know, we kind of mentioned some of it throughout. McGoohan dubbed the gibbering man in the hospital. I will say that because that ties specifically to this episode. McGoohan and number six both had the same birthday. You know, so that was in tonight, then the episode.
Is that birthday March 19th? Is that play into any history that I'm not, that's not connecting in my head?
Not to my knowledge.
Specific happened on that day? Okay.
Wait, when you say McEwen dubbed the, oh, he did voiceover for
yeah,
the
so
show.
Yeah, so when he's like,
yeah, blah, 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 that was McEwen.
What?
So I found that to be cool.
Oh, interesting note that credit cards were introduced in Britain in 1966.
Yes.
And they start talking about credit.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
So, lots of stuff. All right. So as we continue on, we'll bring in more trivia. We'll try to condense a little bit, for the purposes of various things. But the problem is we have to hit so much, so it's tough.
Yeah.
We'll bring in comments. So definitely, you know, participate along because, you know, I do want to read them and open this up as much as we can.
One trivia thing that I want to know that I don't believe we knew the answer to. So I don't know if any of you fans out there know the answer, but I want to know if the number plate, as they call it,
on the Lotus 7. So if we could bring up the picture.
KAR120C, if there's any meaning behind that. I would think that there would be, but I don't know.
I don't know.
No. Maybe someone out there does. I have a really important question in terms of viewing order. Are we going to go with air date or are we going to go with the recommended viewing order of the episodes? Because there is dispute on
There's
the way
so
they
much
should
dispute.
Be watched.
Here's the good news. If you choose not to watch us live, then the good news is you can pick your order. The bad news is next week, I forget why I chose Chimes of Big Ben and where I got that from, but that's, you know, unless something drastic happens and you guys, like, threaten to kill me, that's the next episode that we will be doing.
I'm just going to trust you guys on this, and I'm just going to go with what you tell me.
Do you know the recommended order?
I don't off the top of my head, no, and I should have, I want to say Chimes of Big Ben comes in a little bit later.
It does. I'm looking at the original. Again, I have this book, right?
Yeah.
It's The Prisoner, Volume 1, and there's Volume 2, which I also have, of the original scripts. And on here is Arrival, Chimes of Big Ben, A, B, and C, then Free For All, Schizoid Man, then The General, then Many Happy Returns, and then Dance of the Dead is in Volume 1. So that's the order that I was going in, just because that's how the book is.
Yeah, I think that's actual, I believe that's air date. Order, because I want to say Chimes of Big Ben is like third or fourth in the fans' view. And then I think as long as Once Upon a Time is second to last.
I believe Chimes of Big Ben is second in however they have it online, because that's how I went to watch it last night.
Cool.
That was what it said to play next.
There you go.
Perfect.
So we're going to go with that. But regardless, we'll do every single one of these episodes. So much to get through, so much to talk about. Based off of your feedback, and kind of our own internal feedback, we'll try to adjust in the best way that we can and strive for perfection, you know, every single week. So don't forget to subscribe. You know, you can listen to us on iTunes by searching The Prisoner AfterBuzz TV. You can listen to us on soundcloud.com/AfterBuzz TV. Or you can watch us on youtube.com/AfterBuzz TV. And as an added bonus, if you guys want to participate live with us, you know, you just watch us there.
And hashtag tweet us.
That's right. Speaking of interacting with us, Stefcy has a Twitter. What is your Twitter?
You guys can find me on Twitter at IAMSTEFZ. I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts.
Do you promise not to abuse that privilege of the fans and you won't put out like, hey, today I ate a something?
No, I don't. You don't need to know what I'm eating. Unless you ask me, I will tell you. I will respond. But I tweet about The Prisoner, Agent
Sports.
Carter. Sports. I do like sports. Sorry. And just other fun stuff. I like to have a quote of the day, too. I'm getting back into it. I dropped it for a while.
Nice.
Very good. And Meredith?
Well, if you like cat pictures, you can follow me at MPLACKO on Twitter and Instagram. I have a lot of cats.
Very cool. And again, we want to thank 6 of 1 Society for supporting us. April 17th of 2015 is the meetup. If you're listening to this in future years, just go on their website, their Facebook page, and every year they do a meetup with another special guest. So lots to do. And just tell a friend, spread the word, please. This is the first episode, and we want to make this as big an event as we can. So
be seeing you.
Seeing you.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.